Do you want me to drive?
No, you don't have to drive me. I'll drive myself. In fact, you're never going to have to drive me again because you're fired, Ira.
You are the only person that I've ever heard of that learned nothing from a near-death experience, George. You went backwards. You're worse.
You know what I am? A good friend. I would never run to the airport and rat somebody out. I don't have that in my DNA. That's not a friend, man. A friend tells you. A friend comes to you and says, hey, you're in a heap of shit. You better not do it. He doesn't run and tell the fucking girl. Wow.
Good. Fire me. I don't want to be around you anymore because you're fucking contagious.
You think I can't get another assistant? I can't get someone else to write jokes for me? You think I'm going to lay in my bed and go, oh, I miss my Schmyra? You're a fucking no-thought, and that's the beauty. Once you're gone, it never comes back in my brain.
You think getting Laura would have made you happy?
I know so.
You think if you had a family right now, you'd be happy? You'll never be happy, because you're always going to be stuck with yourself. Unless somehow you can get away from you, you're always going to be miserable, George.
You are not funny.
Well, if that means I'm less like you, then good. I don't want to be funny, okay?
Mission accomplished, Ira. Bad career choice. Comedy usually is for funny people.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. I'm one of your co-curators, Devin Decker, and joining me, my assistant curator, Sejan Serowick. Sejan?
Thank you so much, Devin. And tonight, we are pleased to bring to you the 2009 Tears of a Clown-esque. Honestly, the way that this movie tonight touches on comedy and drama, sadness and happiness, laughter and death is just, it's going to be too much.
It is going to be too much. And that's why I'm dropping the character right now. Because before we can get into this episode about Judd Apatow's funny people, I have a little bit of housekeeping from last month's episode. And I just want to get it out of the way at the top of the show. But it's been eating me up inside, Sejan.
I thought you were just going to just reveal to me that Rigoletto was not the artist. And that you're just
What am I? A huge prick? No, I don't. No, Rigoletto, I believe, did the sad clowns. And kudos to you for just keeping it out of your mouth. No, what I need to apologize for is last month's episode, we did That's My Boy, right? That's My Boy, which, you know what? Spoilers, if you didn't listen to the last episode, we put it in the universe, people. It's there. And we'll elaborate on what that means in a minute. But last month's episode was unofficially sponsored by Budweiser. to the fact that to really get into that Donnie Berger state of mind, I drank a lot during that episode. I drank so much that I thought Def Leppard was Led Zeppelin and that it was they who sang Rock of Ages as opposed to Def Leppard. And it's really been bothering me as a student of both Def Leppard and Led Zeppelin to confuse and conflagrate those two bands in my mind. So I just wanted to lead off this episode with an apology, a correction to the fact that I said that Led Zeppelin sang Rock of Ages.
Well,
now,
and
I would have loved to hear that.
Country
but...
singer has once said, blame it on the bud. So,
yeah. But now, but this one, I'm only drinking Diet Coke because that's all that George Simmons drinks in this. Well, he also drinks some sugar-free Red Bull, and I have a sugar-free energy drink, but not Red Bull because I can't have wings this late at night. It makes it difficult to sleep.
Have you been doing this the whole time? Is this why you were eating Popeye's chicken the entire time we were watching Little Nicky?
Yeah, you did not. The reason I had to get a new microphone was the grease was just, oh, it was terrible. And you don't want to know what I was eating for I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry. It was Hooters. It was Hooters, guys. What are you thinking?
Tequila lately.
Yeah, that's right. Just like Beyond Bjork. We haven't seen tequila in a while. Tell us what you did with her, Alexander Goodenough. Hi, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Funny People episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. As I said, I'm Devin Decker. He's Sejan Serowick. And we are here. We have decided greatness was not what we chose, but it was thrust upon us as all of our friends came to us after Hubie Halloween came out and said, this Adam Sandler shared cinematic universe. What do you two have to say on that?
This Adam Sandler guy. What are your thoughts?
Adam Sandler, you think he's going to do anything? Well, it's 2020 and he's been doing things since at least 1995. Yeah, no, I think he's going in here for the long haul. I don't know. But then thinking about it, we decided, why not, if everybody wants to hear from us on this particular subject, why not spin off from our usual podcast, The Say Report, the show that is about everything, and we mean everything, and try to do something a little bit more focused, specifically determining which films are, you know, part of the DNA of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Yeah, I mean, there are the ones that are obviously connected, and we covered those early on, and go back and listen to those. I'm not even going to spoil what they are anymore because it's been so long. But we are now working through and seeing what kind of distant cousins are out there, maybe, as it were. But we're piecing together this really weird family tree of ours. Bit by bit, we're determining what we feel really is connected to that universe and what might not be. More to the point, because when they eventually do Hubie Halloween 2, which must be coming at this point, I really want to see what other characters can show up.
I know. I really hope we get to see more. Yeah. It'll be something. So right now, where you are smack dab in the middle of season 3 of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. And what we're doing with the ASCU this season is looking at the villains. The films where, you know, maybe Adam Sandler didn't play a villain, but based on the way that society and his fans view the particular film, he's sort of a villain. In the eyes of those watchers.
Yeah, villainous either within the story or perhaps to his own career. We'll determine that as we walk it through and talk about each of these.
So we started with I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, went to Spanglish. As I said last month, it was That's My Boy. And then we figured, why not do Funny People? It seemed like sort of the logical progression.
Yeah. I mean, the big thing for Funny People for me, and a reason that I've wanted to watch it for a while, is that it is one of those movies that comes out. It's not like it's the first drama that he's done at this point in his career, right?
Right.
He's done a few at this point, but it's the first one where he addresses kind of his own self at this point. You know, and it's also not the last. He pokes fun at himself going forward in a lot of other ways that we see in later movies, but specifically like in the Grown Ups films and like him as a father and things like that. But this is the only one where he really kind of takes a swing at his own career and where it stands at this point in 2009 when it comes out. So it's an interesting piece because when you think of introspective comedy, Adam Sandler's not the first person you go to, right?
Right. And it really seems like a natural progression to go to a more introspective piece of comedy where what we had sort of decided was something like That's My Boy is that was an introspective look at his career, but from the outside looking in. Where yeah. Funny People is more of an internal examination of what his career is, as opposed to That's My Boy being that one where like, this is what everybody thinks I am. Why don't we try to give them that movie?
What's the year on That's My Boy, Dev?
That's My Boy is 2012.
Yeah, well, so funny enough, it comes after this movie, and I think that we are going to determine today, and you can keep your eyes out for the evidence, but I think that it is the result of him making this movie and it not being extremely well received, and we'll talk more about that in Facts and Figures in a second, but I think that is what kind of leads to that kind of bitterness that leads him to make a movie like That's My Boy. Because after doing something like Funny People, where he does get introspective and tries to explore something really important about himself and his space in the comedy space and all that, like, and the fact that it doesn't take off in any meaningful way, kind of you can see how that can kind of start turning the wheels in his head. And 3 years later, you get him making kind of a big old fuck you movie in That's My Boy. And we talked a lot about that last week. So go check that out.
But yeah, so it's going to be an interesting other side of the coin regarding the theme of introspection. And the first place I want to start, though, is this is not the first time that you've seen this movie. But can you remember back to 2009 when you saw this and share some of your first impressions?
Yeah, I mean, so it was a Judd Apatow movie, and then on top of that, Adam Sandler was involved, right? So, like, you had Seth Rogen coming in and doing the Judd Apatow shtick, which was great, and I would have already been there enough for that. But then you add to that the fact that it was going to be Sandler. And, I mean, the previews alone had me, right? Like, the way in which, like, it pulls no punches about what this movie is going to be about. Like, showing Adam Sandler playing a merman, like a baby man and all this stuff, and how it's him kind of examining his career. Like, I... I was on board from minute one. You know, 2009, you're at that point in Sandler's career where we've talked about this before, where it's kind of the late 2000s dip in a lot of his popularity. And like, that was not something that I found out later, right? Like, we were all very aware in the moment what was going on with Sandler and the ways in which he was being viewed by people around us. But you know, we had no shame, right? Like, I'm including you in that statement, Dev. Like we didn't hide anything from people. Like, we were like, yeah, Adam Sandler's making a new movie, let's go see it. And people would say, are you sure? And we'd say, of course we're sure, we know what we're doing. And here we are 15 years later, so I think we knew what we were doing.
Not only did we know what we were doing, we kind of branded ourselves as the Adam Sandler guys for a while there. But it definitely, 2009, you see the trailers for this film, and the last like major Adam Sandler like trying to be funny like comedy movie is something like I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry. So you're sitting there and you're like, I kind of get it. I get why that's the movie he's doing right now.
Coming off of Zohan too, right?
Oh, right. Like, you know, I forget about You Don't Mess With the Zohan, but that's sort because that's a 2010 movie for me, and when we finally get there, I will explain why.
So I mean, like, you have I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, where he catches a lot of flack because, as we talked about in that episode, you know, the ways that politics are handled or mishandled in that movie, right? And then you have Zohan, where people basically just that's it, that's them turning it off, right? He does do Bedtime Stories in there, which is the Disney one, and we'll have to discuss where that fits at any point in this show, but he does do the Disney swing that you see with a lot of these earlier comedians and stuff like that,
later comedians, with something like John Travolta and Robin Williams doing old dogs.
Well, I mean, they were comedians earlier in their career, and then later in their career they determined, you know, it's about time I make a good old-fashioned Disney film. I also think of Eddie Murphy, right, doing the As You Wish or whatever it was.
Or Haunted Mansion to that whole thing off.
Yeah.
then also, if we're going to talk about comedians who went one way, Tim Allen becoming Santa Claus and then doing like Wild Hogs. And I know that Wild Hogs is not a Disney necessarily, but it really feels influenced by everything that was happening there.
For sure. Yeah. So anyway, so he is trying to, it's that moment in his career where he's realizing that nobody wants him to be the bro comedian anymore. That's maybe not paying the bills like it once was. And I say not paying the bills, he's still making millions every time he puts a movie out. But when he sees that, and sees kind of the way that the wind is going in comedy, this is a moment in everybody's comedic career, like film specifically, where they have to decide, are we going to start going towards this long form introspective comedy that the likes of Apatow are already making? And or are we going to stick to the like under 90 minute, you'll be lucky if it makes $5 million, but that's okay, it'll have a good run on DVD style comedy? And Sandler eschews both of them in the future. Like, he tries this, it doesn't work. He tries that, it doesn't work. And so what he does is he goes and signs a Netflix deal. So like he forges his own path a little bit, and we'll talk more about that in later episodes, I think. But yeah, so Grown Ups is kind of him dipping his toe into this kind of longer form, and I mean, like, literally, like, what is the runtime of this? 2.5 hours or two hours and 36 minutes?
We're also talking about Funny People, not grown ups.
Oh. Did I say Grown Ups?
You said Grown Ups, yeah.
Sorry, Funny People. Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, so you got some Grown Ups happening? No, it's Funny People. Yeah, it's 2:26.
Imagine if Grown Ups was 2 hours, 2.5 hours long.
I know, right? Yeah. So if we average out between the rated and unrated, it's a 2.5 hour long film. It's 150 minutes.
And so I guess now's the time to talk about it, right? Like how it came out, how it was received, right? Because me going to it.
Well, I wanted to share my first impressions.
Yeah, so me going to it. is just kind of I knew what I was getting into, and I was not disappointed, and I had a good time with it, like, blanket. That being said, I do know that there were people that went with me that night, people that were around me that saw it, and you kind of get that, like, oh, the funny man's not being as funny as I want him to be kind of response to this movie. And that's true of kind of a lot of people in this movie, because you see the cast on this movie and you think, oh my God, all of these phenomenal comedians, everything from Sandler to Rogan to Jonah Hill to Aziz Ansari to Sarah Silverman, right? Like you have all these names across the board in this film, and you go to it and then you walk out not feeling like you had a good time.
I mean, to the fact that in the middle of the movie, Adam Sandler sings a song about the fact that I'm not just your clown. What are you going to do after me? It actively mocks you for wanting to go see this, like, oh my God, all these comedians that I enjoy. And then in the middle, it's like, ah, you idiot. Why did you think that's what this movie was going to be?
Yeah. It does definitely point its finger right at you, the audience. Which, I mean, is kind of the whole point, right? This whole movie is kind of that idea. It's just that's when it's so on the nose. So I came out of this movie very much enjoying it and went on to see it many times after. This is by far, like, probably of the Apatow movies, the one that I think I've seen the most. Maybe Superbad, but he's only on as a producer on that one, right? Like,
yeah,
he's not
that's Seth Rogen and Evan Goldsmith's right. thing. And we're going to talk about that one later on this month, like, just to pimp our other show. Our very special episode is about Superbad. So if you like this, we're talking about that too. Don't worry. You'll get your cake and eat it.
But yeah, that was my first impressions.
So this movie had the unfortunate positioning of coming out after Knocked Up. And I am not going to shy away from the fact that I hated Knocked Up. It is a movie that did not work for me on almost any level. And that sucked because I'm someone who grew up with Judd Apatow, big fan of Apatow and everything that he was doing. So, like, 40-Year-Old Virgin, I was there day one, first in line to see that when it released. And, like, Knocked Up, I went out of my way to get into, like, a premiere screening. I won tickets to an early premiere screening in the state of Rhode Island. And I was just so disappointed that at that point, I was not interested in Judd Apatow films. So when it comes to Funny People, I actually watched it for the first time this past Monday. It was the very first time that I saw it. And part of that is not just the fact that I was had an aversion to Judd Apatow in the wake of Knocked Up, but also as time went on and I remembered, no, I do like Adam Sandler. What am I doing? I was afraid of watching this movie because in 2010, I worked in a comedy club. And I was just that tiny bit fearful that it might hit too close to home. And if my house was the target that I was afraid of it hitting, it drilled all the way down into my basement. It's not just my siding that hit close to home with a lot of the themes that are going on in this film and what I experienced in the world of comedy from 2010 to 2012. This one hit home. And I don't know. I don't hate this movie, is what I'm going to say. But it's not my favorite movie by any stretch. I'm a little sad about that because I think it has so much good messaging and so many, like, good moments in it. But overall, what it really felt like to me the first time I saw it, and it still felt like that when I rewatched it today, it reminds me of the film Stripes in the fact that the first hour of this movie is one plot, and then right at the 60-minute mark, it suddenly becomes a different movie.
Okay, yeah. I think the themes are present throughout. I think it just uses different players, shall we say.
That's an interesting, it's the stakes seem to change.
The reason that I'm hesitating is because you mentioned Stripes, which notoriously is just two different movies, just
which are two movies stitched together. No,
and I love Stripes.
There is a cohesion to these two films, I will say that. But I guess for the first hour of this film, you're rooting for and expecting one thing, and then all of those stakes that they painstakingly established in the first hour of the film are kind of erased for a whole new, like, plot and target and everything like that. Does that make any sense what I'm saying?
I mean, it makes sense. I don't necessarily, because for me, like, the driving force in this movie is seeing whether or not George can pull his head out of his own ass, like, and watching a man that clearly wants to. But the question is it too late? Is it too late in his life? And at first is it too late because he's going to die? But then, spoiler alert, he finds out that's not necessarily what's going to happen. Not entirely disappearing, but like, is definitely removed from the immediate table, right?
Yeah. And then it becomes, is this guy going to be able to pull his head out of his ass because he's got to live? He's got to still be part of society.
But it still is that same idea, is can he get past his own friggin' ego?
Yeah. And it's, I don't know, I didn't expect that. I really thought that there was going to be, like, one singular plot for that, throughout this whole film.
Yeah.
And I wasn't expecting that semi bait and switch.
I mean, like,
yeah.
Let's be fair. Like, as most movies, do you expect there to just be one plot to worry about? For sure.
And I honestly sort of expected that the mid reveal that, like, he's no longer dying was going to be there somewhere, but it happens right at the midpoint, and then it's like, oh, cool, but there's another 90 minutes of movie left.
Mm-hmm.
What's gonna happen? Where do you go from here? And I'm not disappointed at where they go from here, but it does feel sort of like a second movie has begun.
For sure. Yeah. It's funny because we've kind of talked about this a little bit with some other Sandler properties. Specifically, I think of Just Go With It, which I think he actually does pretty quickly after this, right? But how, like, Just Go With It as weirdly becomes a completely different movie once they leave, right? And I think we mentioned in talking about that feels like that's a little bit of that rubbing off of Apatow, right? Like, working with him and how that kind of happens. And pointing to other movies of Apatow's, I feel like that happens a lot as well. So it might just be that that's just kind of his storytelling. Yeah. You know, maybe that comes from working on The Simpsons for so long, is like the 10-minute setup for the 20-minute actual episode or 15-minute actual episode. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I can see it. I understand that. It was not what I was expecting based on everything that I had heard about this film. It actually made me sort of respect this film a little bit more because, I mean, let's just deal with the elephant in the room. We made this movie where Adam Sandler portrays a character with cancer, a villain movie. We say that he's a villain. And, like, as soon as he's diagnosed with leukemia in the beginning of the movie, I'm like, oh, my God, was this the wrong swing? I only decided that because of how people have talked about this movie, the reaction to this movie. And then as time goes on, I'm like, no. This guy, he's kind of a huge asshole in spite of that. And the diagnosis of cancer is sort of the thing that makes him realize that and want to become better.
Yeah, and... Again, just because we named it a villain film does not mean it's because he portrays a villain, right? It's like, as much as he is his own worst enemy in this movie, also writ large, what this movie means for him and his career and the ways in which people react to it are not great. Like, he does not garner a lot of love from fans with this movie. Oddly, this is one of the few movies in this time period in his career where a lot of critics actually get on board for what he's doing. And that is not usual for him. I mean, like, when you look at things like the reviews that he got for You Don't Mess With The Zohan and then Grown Ups after this, like Funny People is actually the standout in terms of the ways that critics receive him.
Yeah, so that's very interesting to me. But I mean, yeah, it's a villain. I don't know if I'm not upset that I now own this movie is going to be what I put it. I think this is something that down the line I'll probably want to watch again, especially as it represents a really interesting time capsule of not just comedy at the time in 2009, but also comedy throughout the 2000s in a really strange way, because those experiences are what definitely shaped Judd Apatow's script.
Yeah, and not just one type of comedy, right? Because I'm going to talk about some movies later on that this definitely is referencing, but the majority of them are focused specifically on stand-up and the ways in which stand-up comedy is at this time. And this movie has a really interesting way in which the ways that it looks at stand-up and then looks at what you do after stand-up, whether that's TV, whether that's movies, whether that's writing. Like, there is a wonderful kind of like amuse-bouche of all different types of comedy careers and how they all kind of get distilled in the act of stand-up in this movie. So it also does a good job of looking at that too.
Yeah, it's a whole tapestry, this movie. It's a tapestry of comedy, and that is one of the most interesting parts about it.
While also managing to not be funny, like, the majority of the time. Yeah. On purpose. I want to make that clear. I don't say that and say because it's, like, bad, not funny. I mean, purposely going out of its way to be just as dramatic as possible in moments.
Yeah, this is a drama. This is a drama through and through. And that is the last, like, final first impression I got of that, is that wasn't a comedy that I just watched.
Yeah.
And that's And that's fine, honestly.
I do think that there was a definite feel throughout the masses that they got the rug pulled out from under them for that exact feeling. But before we get into that, why don't we tell the people what this movie's all about?
Yeah. So do you want to share some facts and figures before I give my synopsis, or?
Yeah. So Funny People comes out in 2009, as we've said, but where it comes out is it comes out in midsummer. So we're looking at July, end of July, and it is a $75 million movie, not surprising. Apatow, Sandler, la la la. Like, of course they threw money at this thing. But it never quite makes that money back, even including in international. So it is a flop by Hollywood book standards, Hollywood bookkeeping standards. It is not a successful film. It only makes about $70 million when all is said and done. It does pretty good. It still stays as number one for the weekend that it's open, and only drops to third or fourth throughout the next few weeks. It isn't really until maybe 3 or 4 weeks later that you start to see it hitting like double digits. But it's a weird time for a movie to come out. I'd have to go back and look at Apatow's other films and see when they came out and see if maybe that was like the Apatow time. But like, it's not early enough for them to hit a holiday, but it's also not late enough for them to be in like the awards, like back to the movies season, right? So like, in a weird way, it almost feels like the production company didn't know what to do with this movie either, right? Like, they got a hold of it and they were like, we expected you guys to make a comedy. What the hell are we supposed to do with this?
Yeah.
So they just kind of shove it out there at the end of the summer.
Yeah,
just
dropping it on July 31st to sort of be the kickoff movie to August and September, where historically films go to die. It's not flashy enough to be a blockbuster, and it's not poignant enough to be an Oscar bait film.
Yeah, it comes out at a time when, like, the movie that opened the week before, it's not even, like, a relatable one, but, like, Ugly Truth might be the closest one that you would maybe say. The Gerard Butler, Katherine Heigl romantic comedy. But, you know, we also have The Proposal that's been out for a couple of months at this point. 500 Days of Summer has been out for a few weeks. I'm trying to think of other date movies. I mean, the actual movies it opens up against are things like Aliens in the Attic and The Collector. Like, those are the other movies it opens up against, like, specifically.
I certainly wouldn't want to open up against Aliens in the Attic, Siege, and I just need to be honest with you.
Yeah. There's not too much going on in movie theaters at this time and maybe that's what it is maybe it's just a weird year for movies. You know, 2009 might just be just kind of a lull in movie releases in general. I don't know.
So the big movies that I think of for 2009, both of them came out early June, and that is Transformers: The Fallen movie, Revenge of the Fallen, I believe is the title, the subtitle on that one.
Okay.
Which comes out and is like, everybody's excited because the 2007 Transformers movie like blew up the world in terms of like, oh my God, this is a viable franchise. So they did what they could to get that sequel out. But then the same day that Transformers Revenge of the Fallen came out, a little film called The Hangover released. And The Hangover is a harbinger of the future of comedy.
Yeah.
In so many ways.
For sure. And so The Hangover, according to Box Office Mojo, has been out for about 3 months at this point, 2 months at this point.
Yeah, June 5th it came out, so that tracks.
Yeah, and so you have this weird kind of aura over like what everybody's expecting from comedy at this point. And again, like, then the promise of Apatow coming in. And so you kind of are setting yourself up to be like, oh, what is he going to bring to the table in this new world of comedy that we now live in? And then what you get is a very not funny glimpse at like the world of comedy instead. You can very easily see how people can start to feel kind of like disappointed in what they received instead. This is also the same year that the Will Ferrell Land of the Lost came out. 17 Again is out there. Just to name some other comedies that have come out this year.
2009, definitely a weird year for movies.
Yeah.
And what we're exploring right now, that 2007 may have been the last sort of halcyon Bruno. Year for a while.
This is the year of Bruno. Oh, man.
Yeah. So. Yeah, we have Borat 2 years earlier, and then Bruno comes out. Like, it's a weird moment. 2009 is sort of a season for sequels.
Yeah.
In just the grossest terms possible. and not gross as in a lot of money, just like disgusting. Yeah. It's this point where, oh my God, all these movies hit so well in 2007. Let's do a sequel. And yeah.
And then, you know, the other interesting thing to think about is what's going on in the world of stand up and at this point. And what you have is this happens all the time. Stand up comedians getting more roles in film or more roles on TV. But this is one of those weird kind of upswings. Like stand up comedy has really, really come back with a vengeance over the last 10 years, right? Like the 90s famously are kind of the pits for stand up comedy. With the 80s being like you couldn't throw a rock without hitting three comedians, right? Mm-hmm. Or comedy clubs for them to host them too, like was the other thing, is that for every comedian there was actually clubs to actually fight for them in the 80s, and that didn't happen in the 90s. In the 90s that all kind of became a
desolate
wasteland
because of Seinfeld and Roseanne and all comedians who we decided were great.
Then guess what happens? 9/11 happens and suddenly we all want comedy again, and so stand-up comedy comes back, but this time it's coming back and it's fucking bitter, right? And it is the bitterness of 2000 stand-up comedy that finds its way into the television writing rooms of and the movie writing rooms of the late 2000s, because those stand-up comedians that are suddenly hitting it big in the early 2000s now have better careers, as we see in the movie. Like they move on to things that are not like having to go to fucking comedy clubs and hope they get on stage, right? So they move to more stable positions in writing these movies and these television shows, and it bleeds through and it bleeds in, right? You get really cynical comedy at the end of the 2000s, and so it's really interesting because of the ways in which this movie kind of looks into that, right? Like really kind of dissects like the toxic like era of stand-up that is succeeding. Like it's not like comedy, like stand-up comedy is toxic and nobody wants to view these people. It's stand-up comedy is toxic and we're rewarding these people is what's going on. So stand-up comedy is also just in a weird point too, and I think that's important to know when you look at this movie specifically and why it is the way that it is because like it's not just trying to kind of fit into the comedy landscape as far as film goes at this time, but it really does lean heavy on what's going on outside of just film.
Yeah, it's disappointing that this film was so poorly received by everybody. Like that's what I take away.
Nobody
from
likes
it.
Yeah, but nobody likes to have a finger wet.
Yeah, that's true.
Them,
nobody
right?
likes that
like,
finger.
That's
I just think it's trying to highlight such important things, and the fact that, like, I guess nobody likes that. Nobody likes the kid saying to the teacher, but you didn't give us homework, right?
Well, it's more like being a 14-year-old boy and you fuck up really bad, and you're worried that your mom and dad are going to come and give you a talking to, but instead, like, your fun uncle shows up and does, and he's the last guy you're expecting it from.
Yeah.
So when you get the talking to from your fun uncle, you're suddenly super fucking bitter about it because he was supposed to be the fun one, right? So in addition to the fact that we all kind of got like we're getting told that like we're bad people for 2 hours, like we're being told that by a guy that we last expected it from. So it's just a whole like it's a whole slew of shit.
We're getting told it by the guy who had his fingers in Step Brothers. Like, what are you doing? But no, we were friends. What? You were supposed to be the chosen one.
No, I mean, you know, like artists are allowed to like live and grow, right? And this won't be the last time that we talk about Apatow and his career this episode, but like it's not the focus of the episode. But just like to point out, like this is the guy that gave us Freaks and Geeks. And then the kind of that is what leads to a lot of not like you point at Freaks and Geeks and that was the impetus for all toxic comedy. But like that was something that kind of opened the gateway for this kind of comedy that we then see, because Freaks and Geeks was one of the few big pieces of comedic culture that really did like survive the 90s. Right. It's just weird. I mean, like, so to then get told by that guy, like, hey, comedy can be toxic sometimes is like, well, yeah, but you started it. It's like the conversation, right?
Yeah, but I was more highlighting, you know what, I accept my responsibility in it. That's why I made funny people. Yeah, but too late. It's too late because you already planted the seeds and they've overgrown the landscape of culture.
I mean, it's a hard conversation to have, right? Like is when do we let artists do like correct themselves, right? Do we ever let artists correct themselves, or do they have to be held accountable for something that they did 20 years ago for the rest of their careers? Not
or
the rest
something
of their lives,
they did
but,
2 weeks ago on the Oscar stage.
Well,
yeah,
it's a little fresh, but yeah.
Well, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Asshole. You made me do that by saying it's a little fresh, but it's one of those situations. It is one of those things. Like he immediately pivoted from that, and it's too soon. We're saying it's too soon, but
when is it not? Yeah, when is it not too soon?
Yeah, 10 years later, from Freaks and Geeks, a 1999 show, Judd Apatow was trying to shine a light and highlight these are the things that are going on, and I'm kind of sorry about that. And it lands on deaf ears.
Yeah.
And it, yeah. So yeah, so that's it. But this is the Adam Sandler show. We got to talk about this as an Adam Sandler thing. And I think it's time for the synopsis. You feeling like it's time for the synopsis? Any other things you want to add before I go there?
Yeah, no, let's do it. I tried to shoehorn it in a segment early already, so let's do it.
A successful stand-up comedian and star of the silver screen, George Simmons has it all. Unfortunately, in his case, having it all also includes a diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemia. And Ira Wright, by comparison, has nothing. A job at Otto's Fresh Market and a dream of one day being a famous comedian. But at least he has his health. One night, at the Comedy and Magic Club, these two wayward souls' paths cross. Ira is hoping to grab a few spare minutes on stage should the opportunity present itself when George shows up asking for some stage time. But it turns out, his brush with mortality isn't very conducive to comedy, leaving Ira with no other choice but to mine George's failed set for material when he is forced to follow. The next day, Ira receives a call from George who tells him he understands why he did what he did, that he thinks he is funny, and offers him a job as a joke writer on a corporate gig. Ira accepts, and get a taste of what being a successful comedian is really like. When George crushes the gig, he extends Ira the chance to be his assistant at the rate of $1,500 a week. Ira jumps at the opportunity, but has his world shook when George makes him his sole confidant regarding his AML, and reveals that most of Ira's responsibilities will be related to settling his affairs. Still enamored by the opportunity to work with one of his comedy heroes, Ira reluctantly agrees to stay. Soon, the pressure proves too much for Ira, and he confronts George, ruining a meal at the Palm, but convincing him to tell the other people in his life that he has a terminal illness. This brings George's ex-fiancée Laura back into his life, and after 12 years, she finally forgives him for cheating on her, and the two reconcile, which brings back all of the old feelings they had for one another. A fact exacerbated when George finds out that he is amongst the successful 8% of an experimental treatment course and seemingly has no more cancerous cells in his body. With this new information, George sets in motion a plan to win Laura back from her current cheating husband, but after their tryst, reality proves less enticing than the fantasy for both of them. George never considered that getting Laura back would also mean taking on responsibility for her two daughters, and Laura realizes that George is the same selfish man she left 12 years ago, and that she loves her husband and the life they have built together. George focuses his anger on this outcome on Ira, firing him and telling him he'll never succeed at being a comedian. However, George eventually swallows his pride, realizing that Ira may have been the only real friend he's ever had in the world, and starts down the path of repairing this friendship by finally offering to help him with his comedy.
Excellent stuff, man, as usual.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
I'm sitting here as you're talking about this movie again, and I'm realizing that 2009, it, 2 years later, with Rogan, we get the Rogan Goldberg headed comedy drama, again more of a drama than comedy, but 50-50 with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, which famously is based on Goldberg's own experience of being diagnosed with a form of cancer, not knowing if he's going to beat it and have to go through it, right? And then he does eventually beat it. And so I'm just wondering if that's already in the water for Apatow and the gang, because like Evan Goldberg is also in that family, right? Like a family of comedians. I should make it clear that they're not like related, at least as far as I know. But Goldberg is in that crew, right? Like with Apatow and all that. So I just wonder if this is something that's already kind of out there and something, and this is part of Apatow's way of dealing with that too.
I was a little nervous that Seth Rogen was at risk of being typecast as being the guy with cancer's best friend.
No, but what it does is it puts him in a position as a guy that can be the funny guy in the room when nobody else is being, right? Because I will say this, for as much as we've talked about how this is not a funny movie, some of the funniest bits in this movie are Rogan, right? And as like the struggling upstart comedian, like is some of the best stuff. And then same goes for 50-50. He's the comedic heart of an already phenomenal film for anybody that's never seen it. But like, yeah, so there's also something going on there. Right, but it's not just cancer, right? Like as much as they name it cancer in this movie, the idea really is death and the idea of what are you going to do after I'm gone, what and was it worth everything I did up to this point? And like, I think the big secret about this movie that I think that I was already kind of like jiving with when I saw it, and maybe a lot of other people just don't want to, and I don't know if this is true or not, so I'm going to sound like an asshole as I say this, but like that idea that comedians are always consistently dealing with this stuff, right? Like, I don't know if I've ever met a comedian in real life or ended up finding a comedian that I followed in any way that didn't dive into this. I mean, look at Bo Burnham. I've gushed over the last year for, I just won a Grammy, by the way, for his performance of Inside, right? Like, in the ways in which that is him dealing with his own demons, and we saw him in this movie, right? Like, so to see him 10, 12 years later, like, making that movie and it being a huge, making that, I don't know, it's a movie. I mean,
it's considered a movie, yeah.
Right. Especially because the Grammy he won, I think, was for a film song, right? Yeah. Wasn't that the...
I think so. I don't know. I don't watch the Grammys. You think I'm going to watch the Grammys, but not the Oscars? I've sworn off all award shows.
I mean... I also have sworn off the Grammys, but on the scale of what I would go back to first, Grammys is actually up there.
I blame the Simpsons, actually. When Homer won that Grammy with the B-sharps and then just threw it away, I'm like, so the Grammys don't matter. The Simpsons said so. Yes, he was.
yeah, it all comes back around. Yeah, so the idea of comedians dealing with darkness, dealing with death, dealing with that idea of that. I mean, like, one of the memories of stand-up that is like burned into my brain, right, is like the Richard Jenny story, where like, and then I was sitting in a class one day in grad school, and it was a stand-up comedy history class. We were watching a whole bunch of different comedians. It was the first time I'd ever seen like an Amy Schumer stand-up was in that class and stuff like that. And we watched Richard Jenny, and I knew that he had committed suicide. Like, not, this is going to be a dour episode, folks, just like strap in, and like I'm going to say it now, like a trigger warning for the rest of the episode, but like the ways in which we watch Richard Jenny, and we watch this thing, and the ways in which he is portrayed, not on stage in that stand-up, in one of his last stand-ups, but he actually does a lot of interstitials where it's like him getting ready for the night, and like a lot of it involves him getting in and out of the shower. And famously, he killed himself in his shower, like, months after they filmed that special. So, like, it's really weird. Like, my teacher felt the need to, like, dwell on that for a little bit. And, like, so that's – that when I think of stand-up comedy, I immediately think of this kind of shit, right? So going and seeing Funny People and seeing a movie that deals with that and being able to laugh at it when it can, but really trying to, like, focus on like, the drama that these people are going through, I was, like – I was so on board for this film.
Yeah, I don't want to like totally blow up what I'm going to be talking about in the first part of the next segment, but there's a moment, right? Like, so I touch on the fact that Ira, who by all accounts is sort of a struggling stand-up, like he's trying to make his way in the world. He's just hanging around clubs hoping to get time. Like, he's not scheduled to be there, but if someone is late or drops out, he will gladly step up to the plate. Like, he's at the bottom dregs of becoming a stand-up at that point.
And you want to really get into the toxic nature of this, and if you're not careful, you think the movie is trying to support this, but if you actually pay attention, it's trying to call it out. He is also not doing as great as his friends are, because he is not shitty. He is not the asshole yet. It isn't until after he has the events of this movie happen to him and he gets a little bit of darkness, he gets that touch of shittiness in him from George that allows him to actually be more confident and come out as a stronger comedian by the end of this movie. I don't love what happens to Ira by the end of this film as like a person, but the way that the film portrays it, I think, is phenomenal. So I want to make sure that I'm separating those two things, because as we talk about the ways in which George treats Ira in this movie and infects him with his own shit, to the point where by the end of this movie, Ira is no longer really best friends with him. They might have some relationship afterwards, like they do talk and stuff, but like I don't think he's going to be capable of ever being close to somebody like he gets to George in this movie, in the ways in which it's a don't meet your heroes story, right? Like that kind of thing.
I don't know. I kind of like to think that maybe they reconcile their friendship and are able to be best friends, that the only thing that was really standing in that way was the fact that Ira at the time was an employee.
Yeah, and I hope that Ira becomes a better person through this event, right? Like recognizing that darkness is kind of needed if he wants to further his career, but being able to keep fucking tabs on it so he doesn't become George, right? Like, right. Is I think the key.
But I also, and also seeing how he rubs off on George a little bit.
Yeah.
And changes him. I do like that moment where it pulls out. I love a movie that ends like that. That ends with, like, it doesn't fade to black. It just, we extend out and the world is continuing going on. And these are two people who are within it.
Yeah.
Because it gives me hope. it gives me hope that, like, the fact that George sought him out and is finally going to help him with his comedy.
Yeah, it, when, it's almost like it's almost like Apatow is a really good filmmaker sometimes. Like,
but a lot of the beautiful moments in this totally come from the cinematographer. Like, and Apatow has admitted that. Like, straight up, he hired Kaminsky to do the cinematography on this because he didn't think that he had the eye to shoot the film he wanted to.
I feel the same way about this comment that I do about Villeneuve not getting a Best Director nomination when Dune ended up winning all of the friggin' technical awards. Somebody had to run that circus.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't... right, so, but like, I don't want to...
The cinematographer did a phenomenal job as a cinematographer goes, but, like, Judd Apatow being able to put together a good movie should not be denied, is all I'm saying.
Oh, yeah, no. And his direction in this film on everything is very, very good. But it's one of those situations. It's the only one because Apatow historically talks and talks and talks about how beautiful this movie is. And it's because he was smart enough to get the cinematographer that he got.
Yeah.
And so I like that. But you're not wrong. As a director, knowing this is the cinematographer I need to tell this story where the visuals are going to be important, that's a big part of it too.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was the whole... But that's how low he is. Like, he is the dregs of the dregs, and he gets his chance to go on, and then he is bumped by George Simmons, which would be like if I were going to go on because I were just in the club and they know that, oh, I know you got like 5 minutes and we need somebody to talk, and then suddenly fucking Adam Sandler showed up. Like, yeah. That's the literal, like, way that everything is built in the movie. So then when he goes on and just beefs it, the easiest place to mine for material and really the best way to connect with your audience is what just happened. But where he goes with what just happened by, like, weirdly calling Robin Williams a suicide that happens 5 years later with the "he's going to come out and slit his wrists" line.
Yeah.
Like, that was a moment where I'm just like, holy fuck. I had to pause the movie first time because, like, there is this darkness. There's a dark side to comedy that we do not think about as the audience, right? That is like, we just want to laugh. And if you're not making us laugh, we're going to find somebody else, especially in 2022, where another comedian is literally a finger press away on Spotify.
Yeah, like, I mean, I you're not wrong. Like, that is the guys that want to make their money are never going to dive into this, right? I don't know. Like, the problem is that my view of comedy is, like, I came up on guys like Bill Hicks, and, like, and my favorite comedian of the 2000s was and will forever be Lewis Black. Like, so the guys that are willing to go dark have always been kind of my bag, and I need to remember that when I'm watching this movie and enjoying myself, and somebody next to me is just like, this isn't fun, and me being like, it shouldn't be. Well, that's not fair.
It's not fun, and it's not a critique of it. It's just the fact that, like, it takes that moment to highlight the fact that, like, George Simmons is up here and clearly he's going through something, right? And
I think of when Chappelle kind of lost his shit there and like ran off and took over that club for what was it, like, 3 days straight. He just kept going. And they just let him, and they were happy to let him because he was funny, right? Yeah. Like, very famously, though, he, like, took the money and ran from his show and then all of a sudden popped up at a comedy club on the other side of the world.
But it is. There's a thing there, and that moment so early on in the film is really, like, this establishing fact that, like, we know it's Adam Sandler. We know it's Seth Rogen. We know the topic is comedy, but we're flipping the barrel over and we're exposing all of the worms and bugs and dry rot that are going on underneath there.
Yeah. And you know, I said this off mic and I wasn't sure if I was going to bring it up here because I don't want to call this movie out in any way that I don't want to throw something on this movie, like what would be called in academic circles catacrestically. Like, I don't want to look back and say, oh, well, clearly they were talking about this when it really wasn't anything we knew until 10 years later. But it really feels like a lot of this movie is Apatow calling out, like, specific people that, as we found out over the coming decade, were really, really toxic to the community. Like, I've used the word toxic a few times just to mean, like, oh, these guys are like a bunch of assholes that talk about women appropriately. And that is toxic. But I mean, like, it's real hard to watch this movie and not think about everything that we learned about Louis C.K. over the last 10 years, right? Like, and who, like, it was a celebrated part of his show that he would walk into clubs and just ask, hey, can I go on? And like, I know that that's how it works in comedy, but for a guy like Louis C.K., who at that point had a show going, watching him go in and now we are learning from this movie, probably bumping other younger comedians and not giving them the chance just because he just wants to get up there and do this. And then like finding out that on top of that, he's also a horrible person. It's just like there's a lot going on that we've learned over the last 10 years. Right. And that's just one example.
Yeah. I mean, coincidence is not causation is sort of how that phrase goes. I'm not sure exactly what I'm trying to say when I say it, just because it's something resembles what might be the truth. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the truth.
Right.
And yeah. One of those things when like you had mentioned off mic and you said, I wonder if they're calling people out, and Louis C.K. came out. And again, of course he came out because he's been in the news recently. We're recording this April, 2022, and he just won a Grammy years after he was supposedly canceled for everything that he was doing and taking advantage of people with the power that he had as, you know, a famous person.
Yeah, so the next time some red hat tries to yell at you about cancel culture, just keep that shit in mind.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But But then to have Sarah Silverman, and I love Sarah Silverman. She's great. I've met her, worked with her. She's great people. But then to have her be one of those people at the celebration moment, and then to think of the fact that, like, wow, this really feels like it's highlighting how these comedians are taking advantage of their fans. And then she, like, historically was one of the people who sort of defended him in the wake of all those allegations. Like, that's just Louis. That's just what he does.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It really felt like even more of a, like, yeah, look, this is what's going on. And this just it's just accepted in the culture that these are how people are.
Right.
And
exactly.
It's just like, ugh.
Well, and so let's get back to Sandler, right?
Yeah.
Because like the ways in which this reflects on him, there's no way that this was some new thing in the environment, right? Like, yes, it definitely evolved throughout the 2000s, but this is something that's been part of comedy for a long time. You know, Jesus, you want to talk about the 80s and stand-up comedy? What a friggin' like clusterfuck that must have been backstage, mm-hmm. and the kind of shit people used to be talking about. Like, you could just anyway, that idea being that like this feels like this is Apatow and Sandler saying, look, this is the comedy culture and it's not great, and it's what drives guys to behave in certain ways. And like the way that George Simmons takes it is he just fucking rides his privilege all the way to the fucking top, and it is privilege that's on display for him, yeah, throughout this entire movie. And like, and the ways in which he then decides to use that privilege to raise up somebody else is an important part of his growing as a human being, right? Rather than using his privilege for himself, he finally uses it for someone else, and we see that in Ira. And like, and it's that is the story of this movie, and getting Sandler to play that character is beautiful. And like, and Sandler wanted to be in this movie. Like, I think he turned down Tarantino for
he
the role of
Glorious
the Bear
Bastards,
Jew, right?
Yeah,
right. He was supposed to play the role, the silent role. yeah, but he was supposed to be in this in Tarantino. It would have been a really wild ride for him to be in two or three really like phenomenal like scenes, iconic scenes of Tarantino's career. And then he says, "Nah, I want to do this movie with Apatow." And you have to imagine it's because this is a story that he really wants to tell.
That being said, if I had to choose between working with someone from Freaks and Geeks and it were Sam Levine and Seth Rogen, I might lean Sam Levine. I just have to be honest about that.
Little Wolverine. yeah, man. I think Sandler was realizing that he was at a point in his career where he had to do something else. He had to do something else, and he had the option to ride his wave, do something else, be in a Tarantino film and get some weird recognition for that and then keep on going, or do something important. And he chose to do something important. And I think that's the other reason why I think I love this film so much, is like watching Sandler on screen in this role, in this story, it feels like he is imparting this wisdom not just on Ira, but on us, the audience. And I'm down for that. I'm here for it.
Yeah, it's also one of those moments where we know that Adam Sandler, everything that we've explored so far in this show, we know how much Adam Sandler is just aware of Hollywood. And if Adam Sandler, the guy who was Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, is showing up in a Tarantino movie, his trajectory follows in the footsteps of someone like John Travolta doing Pulp Fiction like 10, 15 years after he was doing all the big things in the 70s and 80s. Right.
Yeah, I mean, especially with having something like Punch Drunk Love already kind of under his belt,
Yeah.
right? 10 years earlier at this point, but having Punch Drunk Love under his belt and then going in and doing a Tarantino film, it's the same way in which we view him in some of his more dramatic roles now, but I don't think he could have salvaged the fun stuff. I don't think that he could have done Tarantino, chose to go back to something like Grown Ups and come back to drama. I think that he realized in order to walk that line, he needed to do something much more meaningful at this point, and honestly just wanted to do something much more meaningful at this point. It's a weird what if to think about what if he decided to not make this movie, because he did. He did make this
Yeah,
movie, and now we know what he did afterwards.
yeah, and it
But
also
it's
makes
really interesting.
sense when you consider that Apatow wrote this film with Sandler in mind, and not like one of those things where I'm sitting down writing a script and I'm like, Adam Sandler would be great for this character. Apatow did that because him and Sandler lived together and
Yeah.
grew up in the industry together. So when you're
Right.
thinking about somebody who can play this role, or somebody who sort of embodies what a character like George Simmons may have gone through on the other side, or at least could live that character, create that character, all of that leads into it, which is what I'm going to use as my segue into our segment, Something New, Something Old, Something Borrowed, and Something Blue. Which is something we do here at the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, where we look at things that are new to the universe, that came back within the universe, that came from outside the universe, and then something blue, which I think I finally understand what you're talking about with the crazy stuff that you bring up after watching this movie.
We'll see. We'll see what
Well,
you have to say. We'll see. I
all
don't
right.
believe you for a second.
Well, that's fair, but what are you gonna do? Yeah, so I'd like to start with new because it connects to what I just said about the Judd Apatow of it all and the fact that he and Adam live together. And the new thing here, I'm going to borrow a phrase from Dick Wolf and call it ripped from the headlines.
Okay.
And what I mean when I say ripped from the headlines is this is the first Adam Sandler movie that we have seen that is 100% using real-world events and footage to help construct the narrative.
Oh,
And
you mean like home movies and
I
like
mean
personal pictures and stuff.
home movies, personal pictures, Adam Sandler, like early stand-up as Adam Sandler, but then attributing that to the early career of George Simmons.
Right.
Appearances by Adam Sandler on Conan O'Brien or at the TV Land Awards. And like, but that's not Adam
Well,
Sandler. That's supposed to be George
and
Simmons.
it's not just Sandler, right? Because I
Yeah.
think we also see it happen a couple of times with guys like or guys with Leslie Mann, right?
Oh.
I'm pretty sure there's a couple of beats early on
Well,
where we see some.
we see Leslie Mann's King Kong Coke commercial. We see her in that 1996 movie with the Lily who shows up in Mystic Pizza. I feel so bad that I can't think of her last name, but all I want to say is Lily Tomlin, and that's not who it is. But Lily from Mystic Pizza, and she talks about the roles that she played on things like Melrose Place and Party of Five, two shows where Leslie Mann did guest appearance. But yeah, we watch Leslie Mann's real. Reel, reversed. I'm sorry about my spelling thing there. To attribute to the fact that her character of Laura used to be an actor before getting married and settling down and sort of giving up on that dream. So, and it's and then that first one, that opening thing, the prank phone calls, which are literal home movies that Judd Apatow shot of Adam Sandler in the
Such a beautiful
90s where they
moment.
live together. And Janine Garofalo and Ben Stiller are just there because they were all friends. Like, it is some, it's so new for the Adam Sandler cinematic universe
You want to know what's
to
crazy about that? Just to kind of talk about the incestuous love that comedians all have for one another,
Yeah.
is this is a point in Janine Garofalo and Ben Stiller's career where they've been working for MTV now for probably 3 or 4 years, right?
Yeah.
And then you have Sandler, who is on SNL, but he's not taken off yet. That has to be pre-95, right? Because he's still living with Apatow, right? So there's this idea that you have these people that are at different points in their career that still always come back together because that's just the way that these guys are. And it's what leads to nowadays when you watch shows and you're like, oh, those two are always in this together. Or there's always this writer paired with this comedian. Yeah, because they probably love each other very much, guys. That's kind of what happens in comedy. Yeah, but the way that this movie starts off with that footage to nail that point is magnific.
Yeah, it's magnificent, but it's also something very new in terms of storytelling inside the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, if this film is an Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe film.
I'm not calling your whole point into question, because this is definitely the first one that leans into it, but we didn't even see him like in like a yarmulke at any point and like just go with it or anything like that.
But even him in the
like a young boy.
No, the picture specifically in Just Go With It, because he starts younger, right, before he turns into the cool guy.
Right.
Everything is recreation. Everything is like Adam Sandler dressed up to do it. Now, yeah, there might be moments where like a picture showed up or something like that, but the attribution of early Adam Sandler stuff actually being the work of George Simmons and understanding that like that's sort of the trajectory that he follows, this movie is already hyper realistic to me because literal conversations in this movie I have had with people backstage at comedy clubs or like hanging out after a show. Like there are moments in this movie, that whole thing, like, what are you just trying to never get laid? Like all your jokes are about masturbating and farting. Like I've had that conversation. I've been the Ira in that conversation with a comedian. And it's just like, okay, but like, that's the stuff I want to talk about. I'm not doing this to get laid. Are you only a comedian to get laid? And they're like,
yes, that's the answer for most people.
the response was from all the comedians present. Oh, the only thing in life that you should care about is getting laid, Devin. And I'm just like, oh, okay. And that might have been like the first like moment where I'm like,
we are an animal species, Devin. We are meant to procreate.
Maybe comedy is not the place for me.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. The ways in which it uses that, I will point out that feeds a little bit into my new.
Yeah, no, that's fine. We're sharing our news. So
I think a lot of that has to do with that Apatow stink that you end up getting on his movies going forward. Because what you're talking about, it might be the first time we've ever seen this for Sandler. It is not the first time that we have seen this from an Apatow or Apatow-related project.
And if this were the Judd Apatow Cinematic Universe, where we would look at 7 movies...
hey, it'd be a much shorter show.
It would be. We'd be done already, and we could move on. No, I love what we're doing. I want to make sure that...
So we see that going forward with Sandler, right? So my new is that Apatow stank, the way in which he brings what he learns working with Apatow on this movie really forward into his film career. And I think it is because, as I kind of hinted at earlier, like Sandler really does know how to read the room. And it's what allows him to choose the least traveled path. And it is not the, I'm either going to become like introspective or just so shitty everybody could just live with it. Like, he chooses to instead go this other way. And it's because he learns a lot, I think, in this movie. I really do. And you see a lot more than just that. You see things like him playing with runtime. You see him playing with story structure. You see him caring about characters and backgrounds in a way that are very different later on and things like that. Sandler picks up something on this movie and brings it with him forward in his career. And so I think anything that we watch from here on out that is after this point, you got to keep an eye out for that Apatow stank.
I mean, look at something like That's My Boy, right? Which is 3 years after this. It feels so much that Apatow stank in terms of like the same Apatow stank that someone like Paul Rudd picked up from working with Apatow on things such as 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up. Like, it's that same sort of like approach to it. I mean, that movie stanks of Judd Apatow. Let's just be honest. Like, and that's a really good point that you bring up. And we're sort of working it in reverse, Slaughterhouse-Five, Unstuck in Time. But yeah, that old Apatow stank definitely gets onto Adam Sandler here. You're not wrong about that.
Shall I take hold?
Oh, please take hold.
I mean, you already pointed it out, but his work, like Sandler's work, his stand-up and all of that, like the characters and things like that. But what he does throughout this movie is we see the ways in which that stuff is just his everyday life. I think of like the speech he gives later on where he like falls into silly voice and things like that in the middle of like this beautiful speech at the table when he's doing Cheers at the table. And the ways in which he deals with issues and the ways in which he interacts with people and that not as much of Sandler is a character as maybe I once thought, right? Like seeing this movie, I realized like, oh, like some of the stuff that he does on stage and some of the stuff that he does in movies, he just does that in everyday life. That's not just him just doing it for the camera, you know? And the ways in which that kind of Sandler-esque, like mythos of that guy, like from the 90s gets brought into this movie. Like it made me nostalgic for all of his old albums. I mean, especially because like you talked about, like when they open up and it's on the prank phone calls, like it made me want to go back and listen to all of those old albums now.
Yeah. With those original skits, just him hanging out with his friends, having a good time.
Is it Apatow that comes in and plays the son? Or is it Stiller? One of them hops on the phone with him to play the son in that bit, and it is.
I
such
believe
a good
it's
bit.
Ben Stiller who steps into that moment. I think that's Ben Stiller's moment where he's like, "She just threw up in the kitchen.
She just loves roast beef. I can't stop.
I can't stop. Well, she should stop eating it. I just love roast beef. It's so delicious."
Such a fucking dumb ass bit, and I still laugh every time.
And you
time.
Still laugh every time. Yeah, it's one of those moments. So the old for me, I'm going to go sort of with the easy one, just the characters that we have seen him work with, the actors. The big one is Norm MacDonald. I know that, like, we talked about a little bit Jack and Jill. It's the first time he acts with him again. But Norm MacDonald being one of those comedians who is, like, congratulatory to George Simmons once he gets the diagnosis that his body is cancer-free right now. Not that he's necessarily out of the woods, but specifically, like, it's worked. It's worked so far. We can't trace anything in your tests. And it's Norm MacDonald who comes in and he does the age jokes. Like he is totally riding the Saturday Night Live stuff that he did. And also the like sort of toxic comedy that Norm MacDonald was known for.
Yeah.
He
was a king in that swamp. And like, I don't think he would have denied it. Right.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to talk about then the inevitable news of losing Norm. Right.
Yeah.
And how he decided to keep it to himself and all that stuff. Right. So like seeing this again, it was another one of those moments where I was like, did they know what was going on? Is he calling this shit out? Was it they were maybe I can't tell.
Yeah. Like it's something. It's really, really something. But Norm MacDonald in this film, like just and seeing him back and he's such a big part of Billy Madison, which is sort of that flag in the ground. We've established what this is going to be film. Mm-hmm. And then like just the fact that almost everybody he hangs out with in that movie has now passed away. And yet George Simmons goes on.
Yeah.
I mean, Adam Sandler goes on. Like, yeah.
It's a prophetic film. I mean, it reminds you of all those jokes that people make about how Simpsons guessed it, like, 20 years ago, and like, Apatow being in that room. Like, it feels like that coming forward, right? He just has this weird, like, premonition of, like, because I know these things about the world now, I can pretty much tell you what's going to happen in the next 10, 15 years. This feels like...
Well, I can paint you a picture that will pretty much resemble things that will occur. I'm not going to stake my reputation on it, but if Trump were to be president, I can say I told you so. Well, could you stop it? No. The I told you so is enough for me.
I can't stop writing on the magic typewriter, guys. I'm sorry. Does the world stop?
Oh my God. So sometimes 3 a.m. I'm just typing and things are going to slip through. But yeah, that is... It's one of those moments. It is that old of the whole thing. And then also, like, I mean, all the old for me, the hardest part about this movie is not watching it like a Judd Apatow movie and trying to watch it like an Adam Sandler movie. He said sort of prophetically for this episode.
No, I think anybody paying attention to the fact that we've spent more time talking about the film as a film and not as an Adam Sandler film has an idea of where we're going with this. But much like the movie, let's completely change gears now. So his stand-up being a huge part of it and you pointing out that, like, you have all of his old friends coming by and kind of dropping in and making their, you know, making sure their two cents are in the story too. Like, it just, it paints such a beautiful world. Like, it really does. And then add to that the beautiful cinematography that we mentioned earlier, right? Like, it's just
I mean, one of the other things is that it's old friends who are coming back to be in this film. It is not, like, I think about the Gardner character, Diego, and the fact that that's not Rob Schneider playing that role.
Yeah.
Like, it's very much, this is Adam Sandler reflecting on the type of person he was before Billy Madison, before he was collecting that cadre of guys to work with and collaborate with.
Yeah, and I mean, that is true. I didn't think really about that. But the idea that we on this show have done a bit of disservice, as if acting like Billy Madison, like as if they like plucked him out of a New York, like one bedroom apartment, put him on screen, and then suddenly he became this over the next 25 years. Right. And that's not the case. Right. Like he had a life before that.
He did have a life. I mean, that's how he gets on SNL. Right. And,
right.
And that whole thing that speech he gives, to go back to it, about like those two girls just said they saw me on MTV, and how just happy he is as Adam Sandler in that moment to be recognized from that MTV special. What, especially like, and he's probably talking to people who are on MTV all the time, who are working with MTV.
Yeah.
And like, but pre-SNL, because he hasn't done SNL yet in that video. And that's the thing. This film explores an old of Adam Sandler that we haven't really gotten to touch on because of the nature of this show.
Yeah.
Which brings us to Borrowed. And I'm going to go first. I'm going to let you go first on this one, because if you picked the Borrowed that I have and I have to scramble for something else, I will tip my hat to you.
I mean, I could not watch this movie and not help but think about like the stand-up comedy dramas of the past, right? Like the first one that I thought of was The King of Comedy, right? The old De Niro, Jerry Lewis one, right? And so the ways in which this movie tricks you into coming to a movie because you think it's going to be funny because it's about stand-up, but then lo and behold, it's actually like a drama that is exploring characters and life and the meaning of like self, right? And like, this is not the first time we've seen it. And I think maybe that's maybe another nail in the coffin for that day when I would, and I was totally ready for this movie and people were just like, I don't know. This is such a weird movie. And it's actually not, because like you have Mr. Saturday Night with Tom Hanks, which is no Mr. Saturday Night is the Billy Crystal. Tom Hanks one is Sally Fields and him. Punchline.
I know,
you have these movies that come out where this is not the first time that we have looked at the idea of like the aging comic or at least the comic on the threshold of the next part of his life, like looking back at everything that he did to get here and questioning it, right? That is actually like a pretty standard story at this point. And so like the ways in which this movie kind of tilts its hat to a lot of that sort of stuff with just recognizing the bar scene of its time, being really down to earth in the ways that it uses like its settings and stuff, the way that some people show up and they are just themselves versus showing up and being characters, that is a huge thing in these movies, right? But yeah, like this is not the first kind of story like this. It's not as original as I'd like to admit, as I'd like to lie and say it is with Apatow, you know?
I mean, let's look at 6 years earlier, something like Death to Smoochie.
Yeah.
Right? Go just down that same line. That's not my Borrowed, by the way. My Borrowed is way more holy fuck, you just lifted an entire scene. But I like what you bring to it. And yeah, but it was hard for me to view it like that. Like everything you say is so accurate in terms of what this film is aping, what style of film this is. But I was so obsessed with the Adam Sandler of it all that I completely missed it with this in my first couple of viewings. So interesting. Which brings me to my Borrowed. And I was so nervous because you said bit by bit earlier on in the episode. And I'm like, holy fuck, Season's going to say Fletch for Borrowed, and I'm not prepared for another Borrowed, but it's Fletch. And it is the moment where Ira is told that George is sick, when George tells him that he is sick, and cribs and puts together his own version of Alan Stanwyck's speech about, I want you to kill me. Nobody will notice. I have a gun. It's untraceable. And I'm willing to pay you $50,000. And I'm sitting there, And I got to tell you, I am not the biggest fan of Fletch. It's not one of those movies. There are people around us. There are people that I know where like Fletch is the greatest movie of all time.
You're wrong.
Fletch is the Fletch beginning and is... end of all comedy.
Son
like,
of Fletch.
Oh God, Son of Fletch. I'm so sad that we never got it. But yeah, it's one of those things like Fletch is one of those big things. And just like that whole sequence, I'm like, this is Fletch. He's just doing Alan Stanwyck's scene from Fletch where he asks Chevy Chase to murder him. Like right down to like, I have an untraceable gun. I'll pay you $50,000. We're strangers. Nobody
it
will
is
be
the
able.
Joke though, right? Like, can I clarify that that's the joke that it's that bit?
And
like,
that is what I'm going to use this as a springboard to. I don't necessarily know if it is. It is definitely the joke on the meta level, right? Like, the whole sequence is written by Apatow to be a reference to Fletch. There's right. no way that it's not a reference to Fletch.
Okay, right.
But if Ira Wright is supposed to be this student of comedy that he proposes to be, it would be really fucking weird if he didn't catch on to the Fletch of it all. And yeah. then the fact that neither George or Ira says, that's just fucking Fletch. But yeah. I made it about, not even about cancer, because he has bone cancer. I have blood cancer. Like, the fact that there's no lampshade hang on it yeah. really made me wonder after this, like, holy fuck, that's just Fletch, right? He just did the opening, that whole scene from Fletch. It made me wonder, does Fletch exist in this universe?
The greatest joke the Apatow ever told was the one inside yourself. You say that, and I start to think back to Ira's apartment. Well, not his apartment, but the one that he shares with the guys, right?
With Mark and, like, and Leo.
And all of the posters that are up on the walls of all of these famous movies, and you even straight up have a Chris Rock one from one of his album covers up on the wall in one room. So, like, this is a world in which that stuff exists, and like it feels like this is just a universe in which Adam Sandler and Seth Rogen don't exist, but these two people do instead. Like, and even Seth Rogen might even exist in this universe because Ira is not really a one for one with Rogen like Sandler is for himself, right?
Ira has lost 20 pounds and Seth Rogen in our minds at this time is not 20 pound lighter Seth Rogen, which that's also like, this is not the time for it, but it came up organically. So I'm going to follow it. The fact that he's like, you shouldn't have lost all that weight and all he lost was 20 pounds.
Yeah.
Is like really telling in terms of all that. Also, to put that line in fucking Jonah Hill's mouth.
Yeah.
It hits a little weird, this film.
It's prophetic as shit.
Yeah. But specifically, you look at, they have a Fast Times at Ridgemont High poster hanging right by the door to their apartment, right?
Right.
It is not the first thing you see because Redo is the first thing you see, which almost feels like kind of a missed opportunity. And I think those are the moments. I also hold Judd Apatow to a higher standard because I've been with him since Freaks and Geeks and his ability to like craft these like episode long arcs where like you might just get one thing that references to keep a storyline going. So when he like misses an opportunity, I'm just like, bad Apatow, bad. And I feel bad about that. I know that like that's me being an asshole as like a viewer, but the fact that it's a Redo poster that's big and framed and not just the Merman poster that he was supposedly gifted earlier in the thing.
Right.
Like, and it would be one of those situations where like those two chuckleheads he lives with put it up to like try to like appeal to him.
I was gonna say, I would argue that those two idiots probably wouldn't put it up because at this point the Merman movie is supposed to be a shameful one, right? So you don't put up that one of your hero, but you framing it, pardon the pun maybe, but you framing it as putting it up specifically because they think George Simmons is coming over. Yes
Yeah, like it totally comes out and it's just like, and we have this.
Yeah, let's armchair the fuck out of this movie.
That's more of a Say Report thing, and I would be surprised if we don't talk about funny people in the next episode of the Say Report because there's a lot here that just feels weird to explore in an Adam Sandler podcast. But it is just one of those moments where I'm like, but yeah, going back to it, they have a Fast Times at Ridgemont High poster, right? It's prominently mm-hmm. displayed. That's 82. So it'd be weird if, like, oh, that movie, that's such an influential movie to us as, like, wanting to be entertainers. But then, like, for them to have never seen Fletch,
Yeah, it's
Like,
definitely a weird bit.
it's a weird moment because,
Maybe also in this universe, Chevy Chase doesn't exist, and that was just him giving an early poke in the eye to Chevy Chase.
and I mean, Dan Harmon shows up later as a paparazzo.
Oh
It
shit.
all works. It all
If Fletch is
works
never
out.
made, Dan Harmon never goes into comedy.
And Kyle Kinane is not the voice of Comedy Central. It's Bobcat Goldthwait or something.
Oh shit.
Are we doing Shakes
Oh
the
man.
Clown? Eventually, we have to do Shakes the Clown, right?
Not on this show.
Why not? Adam Sandler's in it.
Is he? For how long?
Yeah, see, that's a discussion for a production meeting. But bringing up
Yeah, I don't
Goldthwait.
even remember. We're doing Mixed Nuts long before we do Shakes the Clown, I'll
Oh,
tell you that.
fair. I will shake your hand on that one. I think it's time for Blue, and I think I got it, right? And I might have tipped my hand a little bit. But it's that Merman poster because
Oh,
I
Jesus.
can't think of a bluer piece of trash in this movie. Do I get it?
Oh
Do I
shit.
understand what you're doing?
Oh man. So congratulations, Dev. You picked a thing, and it was in this movie, and that's great.
And it was blue. As that water is so blue.
I mean, it's a kind of a cop out, but it is really kind of important. Like the cringiest stuff in this movie, the hardest stuff to actually listen to, is the we're not quite buddy buddy talk between all the comedians, right? Like if it's not two friends shooting the shit, it's a bunch of really just crass, just gross humor. And I don't doubt for a second that that's because that's the way that these people are amongst each other. But like the toxic stand-up culture is just too much on display. If I were going to pick one specific thing that really hurts, is just the way that women are treated writ large in this movie by those people, right? And thank God that we're given Leslie Mann to have some adult conversations at some point. But like Apatow, get more women in your shit. And I say this
And that's
because
his wife. I mean,
yeah, but so
no,
for
but
Roger
that's what I'm
Whitmore,
saying is that
yeah.
like it's and I'm not trying to be rude about that. It's just one of those situations where like he's literally using a woman who's part of his life all the time.
Yeah,
It's not like
yeah.
he's going out there and looking to cast women. He's
I mean,
like,
he does end up like leading the charge on producing like Bridesmaids, right?
right,
Am I
yes, that is
misremembering
very
that?
true,
Okay.
yes.
Yeah, so like it's not like he doesn't do that kind of stuff eventually in his stuff, but you'd be forgiven if you watched just his mainline movies and thought there's a lot of just white dudes going on here.
And Trainwreck with Amy Schumer.
yeah, so there's just the toxic kind of nature is hard to sit through at some points, like because of just how cringy it is. But like then reminding yourself like this is the way that it was, and that's never an excuse to allow shit just kind of to go on in a movie. But I don't think it goes on in this movie. I think it's there just as much as it needs to be.
It's
It's just
there.
gross.
It's there in a point to truly highlight. Like just how true it is. And watching this movie again, it really kind of put truth to these thoughts in my mind that all these guys that I worked with at the time, right? Like I like was genuinely trying to be a friend to them and like would do anything for them. And I think of one time where like I was nervous because one of them got very drunk and tried to hurt himself. And I talked to somebody else about it. Like, I think he needs help. And I'm freaking 24 years old. I'm not equipped to handle the problems that are going on here. And I don't know what to do. And the level of anger that I got back from that guy at like, oh, you think it's just a funny story? You're shooting to shit. You're telling everybody about it. You think, oh, I'm going to dine out on that story that night he did. I'm like, yeah, that's not what I did. It was real concern. But like, I understand why it attacked your ego so much. And then seeing this and seeing that whole, like, I don't have friends. I basically just have people I shoot the shit with, but I wouldn't consider them friends. You're my friend and I fucking don't even like you. Like that whole speech. And it's just
Yeah.
like, oh, I've been on the other side of that conversation too. And it's so like I talk about like one of the reasons why I highlight the fact that the real world is weird building blocks for this movie is the fact that it's so realistic. Everything in this movie is so true and so reflective of things that I saw in the industry, and it's frankly a little scary.
You know, 5 years later, this movie would have been filmed on Handycam, I bet.
Oh
So
yeah.
it would have felt like you were in the room with these guys, you know?
Yeah, it's
Not so much even now, but there was like that weird period in the mid like 2010s where just everything had to be like Handycam and have like weird moments of like first person to it and things like that. And that would have been the fucking, that would have been all over this movie to kind of bring you into this world, I bet.
Yeah, and I would have hated that. I'd hate that even more because I've already been in the world, but then sort of seeing it framed through the rose-colored glasses of Hollywood really accentuates just how people view the world of stand-up comedy, but don't want to see the dark edges, don't want to see the fact that, like, you're going to be doing shit for no money, or you're paying by having to bring in 10 people to get 10 minutes of stage time. Like, I don't... It's hard. This movie is really hard.
Yeah, no, it's a hard watch, man. But yeah, that was my blue.
And going along with your blue, it really sucks, that scene. Like, I was thinking about it today, taking the notes. Those two girls that they take back to George's to fuck, right? And that's the word. You want to fuck these two girls? They had to take a private jet to that performance, right? Mm-hmm. To the MySpace performance. So those two women fly with them from wherever the MySpace gig is to L.A.
Right.
To go to George's house. And then also her friend just abandons her there because she assumes that she already left. and he has sex with both of them. And like, yeah, I know she had a boyfriend, but like, I take advantage of the fact that I'm famous and they want to fuck me. And it's just like everything about that is gross. Even the post-coital popsicle.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of gross stuff that happens in this movie. And the question becomes, is it gross on purpose? Like, is it knowingly gross, or is it just exploitive? And, you know, that's for each person to decide for themselves, really.
Yeah, it's weird. It's just weird. It's a weird little movie. Which brings us to, well, usually we do the discussion on the movie. I feel like we've talked a lot about this movie already. Is there anything else that you think we need to talk about? I just thought of something as I look at my notes that I would like to talk about.
RZA being in this movie.
I mean, love RZA.
And there's all sorts of like references to like De La Soul and stuff like that. And then that he was a part of at one point. There's a lot of real love there. That was really fun to see. What is the joke he makes about Kramer, right?
Like, but that's the other thing you want to talk about, where comedy was in it. This is where Michael Richards said the N-word in the comedy club and threw everything away. And then RZA's character, Chuck, is like, nah, he gets a pass from me. Kramer's my boy. And he's like, oh, okay. Cool read on that one. And also, like, the fact that, you know, the whole fletch of it all again, the fact that Ira even says, I want to be a famous stand-up like Jerry Seinfeld. But, like, in 2009, like, did you just ignore the last 10 years of the world? Where, like,
he kind of did, which is why I think he's not really cut out for it at first. It takes, you know, it takes him cutting his teeth for a bit with George.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the most relatable moment in this movie where he, like, hires him to write jokes about MySpace, which I would like to talk about the MySpace in the room as well. He hires him to write jokes about MySpace, and he's like, I need you to do 5 minutes beforehand.
Talking about Taylor stealing the fucking joke.
Well, though, James Taylor stealing the joke is fair. Because it's not a good joke, right? And that's actually one of those moments that I really like about this. Because we haven't touched on, because they're not hyper-consequential in terms of this being an Adam Sandler film. Like Leo and Mark and Yo Teach and all of that. But the fuck Facebook joke is Leo's joke. And on the one hand, that it's being competitive and like backstabby, because George does call and say, I'd like to hire you and your XXL version of you friend to write jokes for me. and to which Ira's like, oh, no, he's too busy to do that, but I can definitely do it, to like kind of keep the moment special and his own. Like that's not it's like that's real. That's like a real, real moment there.
Yeah.
And for whatever it is. But. And then like the only joke that he pitches to him that Leo wrote for him is the joke that James Taylor steals. Right.
Yeah.
And like just sort of off the cuff. Right. Like, so maybe it wasn't that good. Maybe Leo wouldn't have been cut out for this type of job. And
I think what it is that we really, really come to realize that the humor that Simmons does, the the comedy that Simmons does that lets him be who he is not like anybody else's.
Right.
And what we see is in Leo is we see the comedy of the moment. Fuck Facebook is very funny today, but it's not, well, it's not even funny today, but it was funny 10 years ago when he said it. But here we are in 2022 and it doesn't work. Right. But right. How many Sandler albums have we talked about on the show that still work? Right. And it's because he's doing something else. He's not making comedy for the moment. He's making comedy for a lifetime, right? And that's a very like sunshiny way to look at it. But that's literally what you're talking about. Is that Ira is learning that like there's two kinds of funny, and there's like funny right now, and there's funny forever. Which one do you want to be? And when he says, "I want to be like Jerry Seinfeld," he means funny forever.
Yeah, and that's also, but that's also why George Simmons is calling up people to say, "I need you to write jokes for me for this MySpace thing," because he's funny forever type guy. He needs to hire somebody to write current event humor because it's not something he's good at, so like it all builds to like a very realistic thing. But then what really sells it is he's like, you gotta do 5 minutes because I'm not following Fire and Rain, which I kind of hate because he's singing Carolina on My Mind, but whatever. And he goes up and he just does all of the jokes that he wrote for him, and he's like, yeah, nice, you did all the material you wrote for me, that's why I fucking hired you. And it's just like, oh, that is such a true moment. Like, that is such early comedian foible. Like, to not understand that, like, you are the sacrificial lamb. You're going up there to kind of eat shit so that when I come out, I look that much funnier. Don't do the material you wrote for me, you fucking idiot.
Yeah, it's a great moment. It really is. And then Sailor is just awesome. It's just like, he fucking did it.
I didn't do this one. And it's what's really nice about that is that he didn't do the one about if you the more friends you have on MySpace, the less friends you have in real life. And then seeing how George Simmons takes what is sort of an archaic joke at the time, let alone in 2022, and really makes it his own by applying his unique brand of humor to it.
Right.
Like it's there's some beautiful the construction of comedy in this movie that
we mentioned Aziz Ansari really early on, right? But the character that he portrays when he shows up is just perfect. The like the catch line comic where like he just I imagine he gets into that bit the Cold Stone Creamery bit, and like what is the phrase that he's bouncing around to at the end, like gotta have it right,
I need it.
I imagine that that's got to be a getter done for him, right? Like he, this is not the first time that line has come up, right?
My favorite thing about Aziz Ansari's character is that he said, what if Soulja Boy was a comedian, and that's all Randy is. And like, you watch it the first time, but then you hear that, like, that's how he built the character, and it's like, yeah, no, you did it. Congratulations.
Congrats. There it is. Yeah.
Nailed it.
Yeah. No, the way in which it explores all the different types of comedy is superb.
That being said, it feels like it comes out of friggin' nowhere, where it is the montage of George doing bits to Ira doing bits, and how Ira's stuff is starting to be infected by George's sensibilities and the way he tells jokes.
Right.
And then all of out of nowhere, like Aubrey Plaza's Daisy just shows up doing stand-up, and like, we heard that she was a comedian, but it feels like it's such like a tonal whiplash in that
it's
moment.
Like, Apatow forgot that he needed to build more character around the only other female in the movie. Yeah. I love Apatow, but I'm not going to not call him out for his bullshit.
Oh, no, please do. That's what I'm saying. That's why I bring it up.
It feels like that is just like, oh, shit, right, this character, and throws it on screen. And you're just like, oh, okay, yep, all
right. Right, and there's the whole thing with Daisy about the possessive nature around Daisy. I mean, you sat in that same apartment that I sat in, and I'm sure you were there when our Ira gave that speech to, well, I don't know if he'd be Mark or Leo or a third character whose name probably starts with J. And yes, I was the machination man behind what happened there. And I feel a little bit bad about it in retrospect. But also, I saw that people around me were toxic, and it was kind of fun to exploit it and see how far I could get it to go. I'm not going to lie.
You're a wonderful human being, Devin.
You know, and yet in my notes I wrote, I think maybe I was just not mean enough to be a stand-up comic. No, my stage is out there in the real world. ruining people's lives. No, when they're watching like the cat videos, we've done that. We did that so many times in college with the person sitting right by his iMac computer showing his videos.
Showing the cat videos.
Like,
oh shit.
Remember when YouTube used to have video responses?
Yeah.
This movie remembers. And it remembers a lot of things that, like, remember MySpace? Funny People remembers. It's just like, but that whole speech about, like, it's like you cheated on me, but we weren't even dating. Like, lived that. Like even the stuff that's not comedy related in terms of toxic masculinity of the time really captures that. And I don't know if it captures it because this is sort of where it came from.
Right. No, or, I mean, that's what I was saying. With Apatow, it feels really weird to kind of, he's either like endorsing this behavior or calling it out. And either way, it's gross because he's one of the grandfathers of this kind of comedy, you know, and I'm being overly mean at this moment because we've been so nice the entire time. But like, that is legitimately what you're getting at and why I think a lot of people have some issues on that side of the fence. Then you add to that the people that were there for Adam Sandler and they're not enjoying themselves because this is not an Adam Sandler comedy. Like, then this, you're not going to win with a majority of people. And lo and behold, they didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also kind of gross that they broke up 12 years ago and he brought her real and her good butt jeans. Like, I've just held on to these in the shrine to you for the day when I decided I was finally good enough to win you back. Oh,
I mean, when do you throw them out? Like, what if they come calling for him one day and you're like, shit, I just threw those out.
You just send them back. You send them back in an unmarked brown box.
You psychopath. Leaking some unknown fluid.
I say that because I got an unmarked brown package that had a bunch of my DVDs in it at the start of the pandemic.
I honestly thought you were about to say a bunch of your underwear in it.
No, bunch of my DVDs that like I had let people borrow. It's like they all got together to be like, we're having Devin Decker Amnesty Day.
And so they, like, Orient Express ending as shit where they all gather together at the post office and like dark room as they all place an object into the box.
Yes, it was one of the weirdest packages I've received. Was a unmarked, it just said Devin Decker and my address on it, wrapped in brown paper, tied with a white string, and like it came to the house.
The package, they all did,
and I'm just like, who do I open this? What do I do with this?
That's awesome. I think it's time, Dev, that we really get into the meat and potatoes of this here.
I need to talk about two other things in the discussion part. I really do want to get into the meat
and
potatoes.
The second I start talking about Poirot and Agatha Christie, I start to realize I'm out of material. So you guys...
No, that's fine. That's okay. I want to talk about... Well, it's three things that I want to talk about. And the first thing is, we haven't talked about Eric Bana at all in this film.
That's fair.
And that is definitely him. And that is not surprising when you consider the fact that despite being the fourth name on the poster, but not appearing on the poster, he doesn't show up until the final third of this movie.
And even then disappears in the kind of in and out, right? Like, I'm remembering correctly.
But the fact that like Apatow's like, yeah, you're Australian because it's easier to improvise in your natural accent.
Yeah.
And what he does, he's so great. Eric Bana's character in this movie is such a weird character. Like the moment where he comes back and he's like, I just figured it out. Because of my friends in China, my Buddhist friends, I realized that this is karma and I've been a piece of shit and you're my karmic retribution. We're all here because of my actions. And it's just like, oh man, Clark, you're a huge asshole. But at the same time, like, I'm fine with that as my out, you piece of shit. Like,
he's a great character. Like Apatow does not overuse him. And it's what makes him so memorable and worthy of being the fourth name on that poster.
Oh, yeah. And also, he's probably the fourth name on that poster because... He was supposed to be the Incredible Hulk, and then in 2008 they replaced him with Edward Norton, and they're like, but Mr. Bana, how about being in the final third of a Judd Apatow Adam Sandler movie?
Compensation role. Yeah.
But the thing about that character is that it would be very easy to just paint him as the asshole.
Yes.
And the fact that they avoid doing that and make it so that, like, when Leslie Mann ultimately decides, no, I can't be with George, I'm going to be with you, you're not disappointed that she's settling for, like, the lesser of two evils. Like,
no, they earn her decision at the end to not go with George, which they needed to. And,
yeah.
and because this movie only works if George does not get the girl. Like, yeah, it could not be a full redemption arc for him. And I'm glad that it didn't.
Yeah, it's really, really good. So, but just some cheers for Eric Bana, because everything he talks about with Australian rules football and the way that he's like, oh my God, Eric Simmons in my house. And Leslie Mann, when she tries to do his voice, is like, oh, it's just to be so spoiler. No, Robin Tog. Like, it's so good. And I just want to do that. But then talking about Leslie Mann and talking about everything that happens in Marin County, the peanut butter game? The fuck is that? The fuck is the peanut butter gang?
I don't know, man.
and it's made all the more weird when you consider that that's Judd Apatow's real life wife and daughters, that he is having smear peanut butter on their faces to have dogs lick it off. And like, that only feels, it might be the grossest thing I've ever written in my notes for one of these episodes, but like, that feels like grooming. That feels like teaching those dogs to lick peanut butter off of humans.
Okay. Man, you went to a different place. But
I went to a different place, but like that, uncomfortable.
I think the idea, though, is that this is also one of the first times that we're seeing Apatow really coming to terms with being a dad. And we see a lot more of this in This Is 40, where like the gross nature of being a parent is where he finds a lot of his comedy. And I think that that's what you're pointing to, is like there is this idea maybe some of it comes from The Hangover. I don't know. But there's this idea that like the gross out nature of being a parent is something that gets very heavily explored in R-rated comedies going forward. So it didn't even hit me because it's just as par for the course as far as I'm like, we still see it today. I mean, even in movies that are not even R-rated, like I was just rewatching the John Cena classic, Playing with Fire. And like, there's the entire poop scene in that with him and Keegan-Michael Key. Yeah, so I mean, just like the gross out nature of kids comedy is just as far as I'm concerned, I'm just numb to it at this point, I guess.
Yeah, like, but poop joke I get because it's a poop joke. Peanut butter being licked off your face?
It sounds like you might just have some other issues you might need to work out at some point.
It just was a weird moment for me. It was a weird moment for me, which then we'll shift into the last thing that I do want to do, which that is Judd Apatow, if anything. If he is anything as a creative, he is the fucking king of the perfect song for the situation. Mm-hmm. He is so good at picking music and putting it into his movies and his TV shows. Like Freaks and Geeks, the only reason why I know about Freaks and Geeks is because of the music in it. I was given a copy of the DVD by my 12th grade English teacher because she's like, I know you love this show and I know you love this show because of the music. And I thought, like, you would enjoy this because Shout Factory was able to get all of the music rights. And I'm like,
right.
Thank you. Thank you. I didn't, like, you don't know how to respond to something like that. Like, somebody actually understanding you, especially when 12th grade English was kind of hard for me. I've talked about it on the Say Report. But, like, and that's where, like, Judd Apatow, like, oh, wow, he understands music. And what I really love in this movie is Seijin had talked about all of the songs that are like about death that show up in this movie. And,
or at least like endings, but yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, endings is more what you talked about. But like the two Warren Zevon songs that are in this movie are both from the album that released 2 weeks before he died of lung cancer. Like, and both of those songs are about how he is dying of lung cancer.
Yeah.
And there's like, Losing Wind is about how he can barely sing anymore, and Numb as a Statue is about the fact that his body is literally shutting down to the sensations of touch. Like like those were the things that inspired. So like it's like those two, holy hell.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, like it's that. But then it's also what is really interesting in this movie that sort of explores the singularity of the life of George Simmons, the fact that he could never truly connect with anybody, is the usage of a song by each of the Beatles after the Beatles split up. And just what that sort of means in terms of being a non-collaborative creator.
Yeah.
Sure, like, it's just wonderful. And Especially the fact that, like, Adam Sandler, you think of Adam Sandler, you think of him as somebody who sings, right? Singing has always been part of the act. So when he does Real Love by McCartney, like, that's a wonderful moment. But it also is really indicative of the type of person that George Simmons is.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I also, it would be a disservice to not also point out Justin Long in a phenomenal role in the redo.
I have questions.
Is it the redo or
it's
is it
just
redo?
It's the redo? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I have so many questions about. So, like, Justin Long, we meet Justin Long and Ed in 2001, right? That's when, like, Justin Long becomes a thing. Or is 2001, 2002? So,
when does Jeepers Creepers come out? Because that's also a big...
Jeepers Creepers is 2003.
Yeah.
So but we're introduced to Justin Long's, like, first, like, big role that, like, people noticed him was playing his character on Ed and sort of being, like, teenage Ed and whatever that was. So when did the redo come out if this is 2009 and Justin Long is, like, a big enough star to go up as the two-hander with George Simmons? Like, it doesn't work in real timeline?
I mean, it feels like it's probably like a good 2006, 2007, because you compare it to something like a Seth Rogen and what he was doing, and the year before he did this, he had like 5 movies coming out. Now, 3 of them were like voice roles, where he was in like Horton Hears a Who, he was in Kung Fu Panda, he was in, what's the other one that he did where he was the voice? But then like he also had Pineapple Express the year before this and like, and that sort of shit. So like you have these young comedians that were hitting it off in like 1 year, and then within the next 3 years you were just seeing a fuck ton of them, and that is a direct cause of the Sandler effect, honestly, is like they just realized that they can just pump a bunch of this shit behind a current hot comedian and it's gonna bring money in for now, and then they could just turn the well off when they realize that it's run dry. They could just go to somebody else, you know,
which then adds to the fact that like redo is this relatively new, so it's like a relatively new movie that they have a framed poster of, because like they're really pushing to do a sequel, right?
Yeah.
So if it's 2006, then that means it was 3 years before the events of this movie. But then you also, the other thing I really dig is that Elizabeth Banks is George Simmons' Drew Barrymore.
Yeah.
Because they did Merman and A Lot Like It or whatever other movie they show in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like, oh, okay, so Elizabeth Banks, we first see her in 2000 Spider-Man, and then suddenly she is Drew Barrymore to George Simmons. And, like, it's crazy that Merman is this movie that everybody talks about, and it's like, Merman, at the most, is 8 years old in this timeline. It doesn't work, but it does work. It's just, it's so weird to me. It's so weird to me.
We don't learn about that midpoint career where Simmons must have just been making the movies he wanted to make, right? Like, we get the impression that Merman and Redo are not movies that he would have made otherwise, but just he's become numb, to borrow the phrase. And so he just makes these shit movies, right? It would have been nice to see more movies from a point in his career where he was having fun making them. But how do you do that? Because like this is way before we get like the de-aging technology that we have now, right? Because like you would need to do a much younger Sandler in order to make those kinds of movies work.
It's the really crazy thing, right, is Wayne Fetterman, as the manager of the Comedy and Magic Club, says that he hasn't been here in 5 years, right? So if we're looking at, like, he stopped doing stand-up because he started doing the movies, all of the movies that they talk about, we sort of see 4 movies in it. My Best Friend is a Robot, Merman, The Redo, and that other one with Elizabeth Banks that I can't think of the title of right now.
I guess I got the impression that it was more that he started doing the shit movie again. I think it's not necessarily like it was a cold, hard line between like him finishing stand up and then doing these movies and then suddenly being at this point in his career. I think it's a much larger evolution, and we have a real world go-to for that. Like it is Sandler in his career. He didn't stop doing stand up just because Billy Madison came out, just because Happy Gilmore was big. Like he was doing stand up.
Right. So I guess
years,
I wish I think, that we so. Saw, because every movie that we see examples of, have to be movies that came out in the 2000s.
They feel like they must be.
Just based upon the people that he's worked with in those movies.
Exactly.
That we are shown. So, like, it would have, and I understand the de-aging technology and all of that, it would have been nice if we could have seen one of those early ones.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And who, I mean, I was joking. Like, who gives a shit? Just do it. Yeah. It needed to be there, for sure, yeah.
They made him look like he had his head on a fucking baby, right? There's got to be most of the $75 million right there. A CGI Adam Sandler head on a baby body for two scenes.
If we hadn't included that fucking Justin Long bit, then this would have been a profitable film.
This would have been a $20 million movie. Why did you have to spend $55 million to CGI Adam's head onto a baby?
Now, did they get the idea for Little Man from this, or were they making fun of Little Man with this?
Little Man came out first, so it has to... I have to imagine they're, like, twisting the knife on Little Man.
All right. Well, we gotta get into...
We have to get into the other thing. I'm sort of distracting, but, like, there's so much in this movie that is interesting and worth discussion, and I wanted to do that before we get to that ultimate thing where we say... Is it there? Is this in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe? And show me potato salad, Seijin.
I think what's really interesting is it's extremely meta. If you told me we were looking at the redo or Merman, we could be having a different conversation right now. Like, I almost want to just put Baby Sandler in, or Baby Simmons, I guess, into the cinematic universe on his own, and everybody else doesn't get to be, right? It's really weird. There must be, like, XBs of Us in this film somewhere, right? Like 10 years down
doing
the line.
Doing the George Simmons cinematic universe. Exact thought that I had is that we exist in this universe.
So this movie, no. The movies within this movie, oh, yes.
So I guess how I would make it work, right? Because... ultimately, the ultimate weird goal of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast would be if down the line that the Adamvengers comes out and we bring them all together. I think that this would be sort of like a bizarro world that they wind up in.
A Sony Spider-Man cinematic universe, if you will.
Oh.
This would be the Morbius of the... of the MCU.
You fucking asshole. Nice job.
Would you prefer Venom or Venom versus Carnage?
Golf clap. It's Venom, Let There Be Carnage.
That's fair.
Let's at least get the title of the movie correct.
As somebody that cares very much about those movies, I apologize to you. I mean, you're the one that cares, not me.
I know. I understood the slight jab in the ribs you gave me. Excuse me while I remove the knife from my heart. It'd be one of those situations where, like, we need to collect them all together, and they open up a window into a universe, and it's Merman hanging out with Baby Simmons, and they're like, "Oh, hello."
Yeah, and Ray Romano plays the Vulture in that universe. But it's okay, we brought him into this one.
Yeah. You know what really makes me just so happy for Judd Apatow regarding this movie, not related to Adam Sandler, is the fact that after making Everybody Loves Raymond jokes in 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up, he finally got Ray Romano to be in one of his movies. And in, like, what is sort of one of my favorite bits, Eminem in this movie. We haven't even talked about him. And it's sort of a huge connection point in terms of, like, Vanilla Ice in That's My Boy.
Yeah,
right?
Kind of. I thought you were going to say Eminem then showing up in the interview with Rogan. But yeah.
What about them talking about eventually we're going to go to North Korea? And then eventually Seth Rogen goes to North Korea. Like, this is the Simpsons of comedy movies.
Oh shit!
Yeah, but that scene where, like, Eminem's is like, man, like, you should have just died, like, you did it wrong, you had an out, and then, like, who the fuck is that guy? Oh, that's Raymond from Everybody Loves Raymond.
Like, did you make a consensus, my friend? I don't think that you.
Oh yeah, no, this is totally not. If Rob Schneider had been his gardener, maybe. Here is the argument that I made when somebody asked me, when I told someone we're doing funny people, and I'm like, really, for the Adam Sandler cinematic universe? And I'm like, yeah, no, the second Jonah Hill was in this movie, I'm like, perfect fodder for the Judd Apatow cinematic universe, but not in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
I'm only sad that we won't get to see Eric Bana be up against the other evil exes, but that's okay.
I mean, I would love to see Eric Bana and Eric Gordon go like toe to toe. But I mean, it's I can't.
Oh, you wouldn't like me when I'm angry, mate.
Oh, you wouldn't like it. You wouldn't like it.
That's I'm gonna be kind and say that was my Leslie Mann impression. That's what I'm gonna say.
Oh man, that was solid. That was two more points to Sejan, right? If we were keeping points, if the points mattered. Yeah, it's if this isn't gonna be one where like that's my boy, where I like was so like I really don't want to put it in there, but then it's like too important to not put it in there.
Yeah.
Like, it works too well to, like, ignore that, like, even though there's some really nasty stuff in that movie, yeah, this movie is just, is too grounded in reality to
real.
Exist in the surreal world of...
Penguin could not show up in this movie, and it would be a bridge too far for this film if a magic penguin showed up.
The saddest part about me is that Mark's grandfather is not playing backgammon in hell with Hitler between pineapple enemas. Because, like, I'm like, oh my god, they mentioned hell! Maybe! And I'm like, no, there's no way! There's no way! Because there's an absence of Adam Sandler in this universe, but that hole has been filled by George Simmons.
Yeah.
Like, somewhere along the line, he just, like, assumed his identity. Which is made all the more strange by the fact that he does the bar mitzvah joke. They show Adam Sandler being like, last time I wore a suit was my bar mitzvah, and that was the most money I ever made in one day. And then he's like, I had no religion growing up. And it's just like, but I feel like George Simmons did have religion growing up. And also that was part of your bit when you were younger. And there gotta be comedy nerds in this universe, right? Isn't one of our characters a comedy nerd?
Without having to get too deep into the religious nature of Judaism and the fact that you can be Jewish and not be a practicing Jew is actually pretty common. I know.
It's...
Anybody that's going to dig deep enough to call him out on that should also go the last step and recognize that, like, just because he had a bar mitzvah does not make him.
Well,
religious.
He actually goes the last step in that, and he's like, "You think if there was a God, there would have been a Holocaust?"
Yeah, right.
Like, he takes the time to do it, but like. It was one of those moments, especially when you consider that it is well documented that all of the actors in character wrote their character's stand up. Like, that's just how it was done. That's how Apatow wanted to do it.
Yeah.
So it's not written by Apatow. That was like one of my big questions was, are all these bits that they're doing something that Judd Apatow wrote for them to say as these characters? And then, no, I mean, the nature of Judd Apatow and the whole improvisation that he's a big fan of when he creates movies, no, this is probably the most scripted of his films up to this point, but the scenes where they're doing stand-up, that is totally be this character and write a set.
Right.
And it works really, really well. And I think it also is a nice way to differentiate between the type of comedy that Adam Sandler is known for and the type of comedy that George Simmons is doing and known for.
Right.
In a way that, like, allows them to be two distinct voices in comedy. Which also sort of speaks to the thing that, like, Adam Sandler was probably around this stuff, but it's not necessarily calling out things that he did. Though, as just a capper to it, the whole "let me see a penis" line, right? Let me see the thickness. Let me see it. All that, like, show me your cock stuff that happens in it. Which, again, real shit that I've lived. I don't know what about toxic masculinity really makes other people want to see your penis. But been there, had that conversation. That's all inspired by a real conversation that Judd Apatow and Adam Sandler had. Where Adam Sandler was like, "Show me your cock." He said it on David Letterman in 2007, 2 years before this movie came out. So, like,
man.
I don't know. I honestly, I don't know how much is there. There's also a lot of talk that it is inspired by his time working with Gary Shandling, though it's not supposed to be an ex before Gary Shandling. So interesting. That, which is an interesting thing to see and hear, right?
Yeah.
Because that made me think, oh, maybe it is, though, and you're just trying to protect yourself
cover
from
your
a
ass,
legal
yeah.
standpoint.
Yeah.
Also, Carla Gallo's in this movie, and that was the other moment where I'm like, this is the Judd Apatow cinematic universe, and Adam is just visiting, much like us, as these like cartographers to try to build our Adam Sandler cinematic universe, and you are going way off the map into a completely different star chart, because this is not part of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
No, this ain't it.
This is
recommend the movie. Be, you know, like go in, especially if you spend all this time listening to us talk about it.
Yeah, but, you still haven't seen it? Go. And the weirdest thing is there's still so many plot points that we have not touched on at all. And that's something, right?
Yeah. I've only in passing mentioned Jason Schwartzman's name once.
Right? And I have specifically tried to avoid Jason Schwartzman because every time he comes up on the Say Report, I kind of spiral off into that song that Phantom Planet clearly wrote about me called Devin's Rejection.
Oh, man.
You know, back all when right, Schwartzman was a member.
Any other thoughts that you want
to
put on?
Yeah, so the last thing I want to talk about regarding funny people before we wrap everything up is there is a bit of trivia on IMDb that it made me yell at you when I started my note-taking viewing of this film. And that's because Amazon X-Ray, it showed it when I started the movie. And that's that this is a slant adaptation of The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald, even down to the fact that there is a character named Daisy. And I'm interested in how you feel about that take on this movie.
No, I don't... Oh, man, he's George, Daisy. No, we're not doing this. It is not. It is. That's a bunch of shit. That's a bunch of bullshit.
It's not. If, and huge if, Leslie Mann's character were the Daisy, maybe I could buy it. But the fact that it's Aubrey Plaza's sort of like, oh, goddamn, we need another female character in this whole thing. And why don't we make her a prize and object of affection for every other man in the movie? Named Daisy, then I think I could maybe get behind it. Like,
if it is, I've been giving Judd Apatow too much credit this whole episode.
Well, I mean, it's such a weird thing.
Because it's not a good one.
But I thought about that, and then I'm like, oh my god, he's swimming in the pool. I totally understand how somebody could see this, right? He lives alone in the stately manor, but like, it's not like he's actively pining for Leslie Mann's character until he is faced with his own mortality.
No,
like,
but he is pining for what you represent.
Oh, yes, the nostalgia. This, we talk a lot about nostalgia on the other show, The Say Report. This is such a wonderful exploration of just how dangerous living nostalgically can actually be.
Yeah, on all counts, because the ways in which they all emulate George Simmons because he was the comedian of their youth is also a huge
is
toxic
a huge
point,
thing.
Right?
Yeah, the fact that they both Laura and George pine for the relationship they had 12 years ago, despite being very different people from when that was happening. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a weird one. It's weird, but the whole Great Gatsby of it all, I'm like, I could kind of see it. And then I guess that makes Ira Nick Carraway, but then it all kind of fell apart very quickly. So like, that's a cursory judgment there that I can't stand behind. And I'm glad that you also agree with that, because I imagine you have not read The Great Gatsby nearly as many times as I have.
I've seen that Baz Luhrmann movie, though.
I've never seen the Baz Luhrmann movie.
That man makes a good show.
I have a signed copy of The Great Gatsby. Rory Scovel signed it, and he wrote, I wrote this. Love, Rory Scovel. And that's just, I mean, and yeah, that was a good time, right? Comedy has been a big part of me, and then seeing this movie and being like, man, it's good to know that I wasn't the only one who noticed this stuff. All right, so this has been the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. New episodes release the second Friday of every month is sort of what we shoot for. We try to release them close to the 9th because of, you know, Adam Sandler's birthday being the 9th of September. So that's sort of how the secret sauce is made. And this has been Funny People. We're exploring villains this season. That's sort of the theme. That's everything that we're looking for, which is why next month in May, we're going to be looking at Ridiculous Six.
The biggest villain of Sandler's career. Yeah, man, we're going to have to dive in, and we're going to finally start talking about his time with Netflix and his breakout movie, The Ridiculous Six.
Yeah, because the only other – we've done, like, murder mystery, but – yeah, we're going back to the Netflix stuff.
I honestly forgot Murder Mystery was part of that whole deal because it is on a level
it's
so far
different from the other ones.
Anyway, yeah, we'll talk about it.
So it's Ridiculous Six next month. If you want to make sure you're prepared for a discussion, that'll be coming in May. If this show is hyper-focused, which we try to look into the Adam Sandler stuff, and that tends to be the only topic, but if you liked us on a hyper-focused topic and would like to hear us talk about literally everything, we also do another podcast that's called The Say Report, and new episodes of that drop every Monday. That's when those come out. And we also tend to do very special episodes. And as we mentioned, it's going to be super bad this month. So if you haven't gotten enough Seth Rogen and Judd Apatow and Jonah Hill from this episode, come seek out our super bad episode.
Nice.
So that'll be fun.
Yeah, man.
Just Devin Decker, Seijin was not a part of it. And it actually makes me sad that he wasn't a part of it. I was invited to be on a podcast to discuss The Wedding Singer, and the name of that podcast is The Hold Up Podcast, and we explored whether or not The Wedding Singer still holds up. And very much like this show, I did not seek them out, but they came to me, because somehow I've become a Adam Sandler aficionado.
Scholar is the word, my friend.
Oh, scholar. Yeah, scholar does sound much better. Yes, I am a scholar of Mr. Sandler. So if you want to hear me talk more about The Wedding Singer and our Wedding Singer episode, which is out there and still available, has left you wanting more, seek me out on the Hold Up Podcast. If you want to talk to Seijin about any of your thoughts regarding Adam Sandler's cinematic universe or Adam Sandler's films, or, you know, even just movies in 2009, because he mentioned a lot of them, he is available on Twitter at Siege versus the World.
If you want to get a video response to your cat's video that you posted on YouTube, then go ahead and send it to Dev, and he'll post you right back. You can find him at Devin D. Decker on Twitter.
Thank you, Siege. And I was afraid that you were going to, you know, have them request more stories of my times in the comedy world, because, you know, you used to be an asshole like that. But I think you learned something after watching Funny People again, and I'm hoping for a happier, more well-rounded Siege going forward. You think that's going to happen?
You aren't funny.
You are not funny. All right. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good night. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me. And we'll see you next time.